My name's Chris Kirk, and this is TW Talks, the interviews podcast from 3 Weeks Edinburgh. I'm sitting in the Assembly Club bar. We're at the heart of the Edinburgh Fringe. It's happening all around us, and we're talking to some of our favourite Fringe performers who have shows at this year's festival. Today, Josh Picard, whose show Getting Off is on at Assembly Roxy. Let's get TW talking to Josh. So I am still sitting here in the Assembly Club bar. My next guest has joined me. Josh Picard is here. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
It's are you an early riser during the Fringe?
Earlier than many, but probably later than a good amount too.
I mean, it's 11:30 by now, so
yeah, exactly.
Even in the Fringe,
this was not early. This
not
a good
that
time.
Early. I didn't get you out of bed at 7 a.m.
No.
To record a podcast. It's your first year at the Fringe.
Yep.
As we record this, we are 1 week in. Mm-hmm. How are you finding the experience so far?
It's been amazing, but it's also very overwhelming. I mean, I had no idea what to expect coming in, performing a show every day, seeing tons of shows every day. It's incredible, but I'm glad it's time limited.
That's true. But I guess we're about a third of the way through.
Yeah, more or less.
And it is, we're recording this in the middle of week one. We're currently in the lull.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're experiencing the lull.
Definitely.
Because the first weekend, everyone's excited.
Yeah. Then two for one.
All the discounts.
Yeah.
And then all sort of falls down.
Exactly.
The next week, everyone gets ill. And then the third week.
That's what it's fun.
We all enjoy the third week.
I have a lot of friends coming the third week, so I'm looking forward to that.
So past, present, and future is the format. So we're going to talk about your journey in comedy.
Great.
And this year's show, although in some ways they're kind of the same thing, because quite a lot of the show is about your journey into comedy and the life that preceded and went against it.
Definitely.
And then we'll talk about future objectives. I guess before we talk about your journey in comedy, do just quickly, because obviously you had another profession, which is very relevant to the show. So maybe let's quickly talk about the profession that preceded comedy.
Sure. So I was a lawyer for 7 years, and I defended men on death row in the US, which was a very intense and interesting job. And then I left that, and now I'm doing comedy about that work and about the death penalty. So I'm trying to blend the two in a unique way.
As I understand it, obviously, don't give it too much about the show.
Yeah.
People need to come and see the show to get the full story. But as I understand it, when you didn't, your legal career did not immediately start with representing people on death row. You got a job at a big law firm.
Yeah, exactly.
And then through that, you randomly ended up into this
totally random,
fascinating, sinister, and very sort of unique side.
I just went to a regular law school. I didn't have any thoughts about what I was going to do. Went to a law firm, and then a friend of mine asked me to join a case, a death penalty case. And honestly, when I got asked to join it, I was like, this sounds incredibly intense. I don't know if this is for me. I don't know about representing people who have been convicted of murder. And just the longer that I was doing the work, the more interesting and meaningful I found it. So this has been a journey of coincidences, randomly following different paths, both to death penalty and to comedy.
So you did that one case through the firm where you were working. Mm-hmm. And then I think ultimately you moved to an organization that specialized in representing people. So I guess coming from a UK perspective, where fortunately we have put that principle behind us, talking a little bit about that in a moment. But in the US, in terms of those crimes where the death penalty is possible, you have a distinction between state level and federal level, right? Sometimes it's done in the state court, sometimes federal courts, and you were focusing on
the federal. Yeah, exactly. So when I was at this law firm, I did exclusively Alabama state cases. And then I moved to be a federal defender. So I did just federal cases. And the federal death row is in Indiana. So all my clients were in the same prison in Indiana, but I lived in New York. And so I would go and travel and see them in Indiana. I would go all over the country to meet, their friends and family. But the thing that was really crazy about doing federal cases was that the president can grant clemency. And so there's really an interplay between politics and the law in a way that you don't have in a lot of criminal cases, just because they garner so much national attention. So that was such a different piece of the work to be doing this political advocacy, trying to get, members of Congress on board, trying to get different international organizations to care. And we've actually worked a lot with the UK and EU organizations to advocate against the death penalty in the US, because people are much more informed and have some really nice opinions here.
So when you work on those cases, were you working on the initial case because it was a crime where the death penalty could potentially be the ultimate sentence?
Mm-hmm.
Or had they already been sentenced and then you were representing them as they try to get it sort of moved down to a life sentence?
So I did all post-conviction cases. So all my clients already had death sentences, were in prison, and then we were looking back and trying to overturn their sentence. So,
and you weren't generally saying they were innocent, there was a miscarriage of justice. It was more, this sentence is inappropriate.
Yeah, well, I mean, it kind of depended. If you have a death sentence, you have a right to what's called post-conviction counsel.
Yeah.
So lawyers to challenge your sentence. So we got a case and we would look and say, you know, is there an innocence issue? Is there issues with, you know, judicial misconduct, or did the jury do something inappropriate? So I tried not to come in with preconceived notions, but I didn't have any cases where innocence, like, was the main thing, like there was new DNA evidence or anything like that. So you would just get the big case file and look through it. You know, I'd have cases where there were 4 million pages of documents, and you're spending days and days looking through everything that happened. And sometimes it can be a little small thing that you find where, you know, a juror, for example, read a prayer in the jury room. You're not allowed to bring religion into the jury room, and that can be the basis for something to overturn a case. But the problem is that I meet clients who already had death sentences. They'd already had all their lawyers fail them. And so I come in and they're not trusting of their lawyers or legal team. So the relationships were really difficult but important to build. And that's really what my show is kind of about, is the relationships that we made. I'm a gay Jewish guy from Boston. I don't have a lot in common in theory with people who are on death row, but we somehow really got along, and I really care about them and they care about me. And that's, I think, an aspect of this work that really isn't shared a lot.
So if we now move on to the comedy career.
Yes.
So initially those were happening at the same time.
Yeah.
So what was it with this quite serious,
very serious,
you know, very emotional child made you say on the side, initially, I'm going to go new comedy.
Yeah. In the back of my head, I always thought I was really funny, basically, and had a really good time laughing with clients. And I felt like I was always laughing at work and wanted to just try comedy because I was living in New York. I thought it would be a good community and it sounded fun, honestly. And then the more I was doing stand-up, I started telling jokes about the death penalty and felt there was something different in the room. And people really could listen to it and hear different pieces of the work in a way that, in like one-on-one conversations, I felt like sometimes people would get, I don't know, maybe a little adversarial or combative. And for whatever reason, when I would talk about doing this work, it brings things up for people. And I don't totally know why that is. So telling jokes, I felt like it was really a cool way to share this experience. And then doing that, I started doing improv, and I just loved performing. And so kind of blending these two worlds felt like a really fun thing for me. It felt meaningful and I was getting really nice reactions, and so I kind of went with it.
And were you initially doing the open mic nights?
Yeah.
5-minute slots?
Definitely 3-minute slots. Yeah, I did open mics anywhere I could. And, you know, I lived in Brooklyn at the time. There's a really nice alt comedy scene in Brooklyn. And then in Manhattan, it's much more the clubs.
Yeah.
So I was always kind of nervous going and doing clubs in Manhattan where, you know, people wanted to hear normal stand-up.
Well, I guess that's the thing is because I guess with your story is perfect for the one-hour show. We get here. Because you have the time to set it up and give the background. Whereas you just going to immediately walk on stage and I've got it in 3 minutes. I've got to almost explain the background
totally
and make you laugh.
Yeah, it was
it's
hard.
A tall order.
Really tall order. And, you know, I had a lot of friends who I thought were really funny and were having a lot of success posting clips on Instagram and on TikTok. And I was like, how can I just post like a 30-second stand-up clip about the death penalty? It's like no context, no anything. So it was hard to figure that out. And I realized that a one-hour show was really probably the best way to do that. And I felt like there was something I needed. Like just performing in the clubs wasn't necessarily getting me what I wanted. And so I heard about this clown school in France called École Gaulier. And I went for a summer program last July and was just like blown away by this place.
And to get them out, so you were, up until that point, you were still working for this organization representative.
I took vacation time and went.
Okay, so you did it in your holiday.
Yep.
Went to clown school.
Yep, just for a month. And then was like, they have a year-long program.
Yeah.
And I was like, I have to come back for this. This is like the best place in the world. I felt like I was changing so much. I felt like I was learning how to perform better. I'd always felt like my writing was really strong and the performance wasn't matching the writing.
Yeah.
And so this felt like a way to really focus on that piece. They're really intent on, you know, not using words. How do you use your body to tell stories? And so I wanted to go back. And so I ended up leaving my job and going to this clown school for the past year.
And I guess that's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, because of the way that they are teaching performance.
Yeah.
Yet your comedy is very wordy because you've got an incredibly good story to tell. And yet, but you felt that having the learning the more physical aspects of performance helped you deliver the story
absolutely.
Better.
And, you know, there was a version of the show earlier that was much more clowny. And just in performing works in progress and getting feedback from people, what I just kept hearing was people wanted to hear the stories.
Yeah.
And so I pared it back and made it really as simple as possible. And I think there is really a clown version of this show at some point in the future. But even though the show is a wordy storytelling show, I've been incredibly influenced by the teaching there.
Yeah.
Like one of the main things is that you should always be on stage having fun, having pleasure. Telling difficult stories is not the most inherently pleasurable thing, but it's still fun for me to see people react and to hear the experiences. And so that has totally changed the way that I feel when I'm on stage. And with such difficult topics, you don't want the person telling the story to seem stressed or to seem anxious about the performance of it. So I think that's allowed people to feel comfortable in the room.
I know some comedians, when they first do their hour, particularly if they've come from a sort of where in the clubs they are very much set up punchline.
Right.
And then I think there is the general feeling once you're doing an hour show, you can't have an hour of just laugh, because people can't cope with that.
Right.
So you have to have those moments where actually you're not being funny.
Yeah.
And a lot of the sort of more traditional comedians really struggle with that, with those 5 minutes where I'm just going to talk really interesting.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't know, maybe because that's at the core of what you're doing, are you more used to this idea of, I can have 2 or 3 minutes telling quite detailed, sometimes quite upsetting, emotional story, and it doesn't matter, providing I've got a really good laugh at the end of it.
Right. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I spent a lot of time arguing in court, and you're not trying to get laughs with judges, so I feel comfortable just speaking. It definitely has taken time for me to adjust to when people are quiet in the room, are they rapt with attention or are they bored? And I really think people are really kind of on the edge of their seat listening to the stories. And I know in the back of my head that I have punchlines coming. So I'm never too worried about whether or not it's going to get a laugh. What's more fun for me is to see the different audiences on different nights, because there are some jokes that people really laugh at a lot, and sometimes people are really more contemplative about it. So, you know, that's the fun of getting to perform so many times.
In terms of the 1 hour show, at what point were you able to say, okay, I've been doing the 5 minutes, 10 minutes, whenever, I'm now ready to actually do the full show that allows you to tell the full story?
Yeah. So I was doing stand-up all the time until I left for clown school and about a year ago. And I didn't do almost any stand-up at clown school. It was just like not the vibe.
And no law anymore.
No law either.
The two aspects.
Right, exactly. Well, it's strange being here and feeling like so much of my identity now is about law.
Yeah.
Because for the past year, it was like, was I funny on stage, you know, with a banana? So just being at school, I felt like I can do this. Like I had the capability to like come up with new performances every week and just to try something. So I spent a lot of time writing it this year, and just seeing how fun it was for me to be on stage all the time gave me the confidence to do it. But it really was not doing stand-up and storytelling that I felt like I could do an hour of stand-up and storytelling.
One thing I took from the show is you talk about some of the cases that you were involved in, the people involved, and you're not necessarily going into great detail about the cases,
right.
Not necessarily trying to defend their actions at all. In some cases, they are horrible actions which you cannot defend. But you did a really good job of humanizing even the worst people that you've represented.
Yeah.
And I guess is how easy is that to do? And do you sense that some audiences don't want people who've committed such horrible crimes to feel more human?
Yeah. I think people really vary. There's one case in particular I talk about where there's a particularly difficult set of circumstances. And I really struggle with how to talk about that in the show, honestly. And I felt like people are willing to go there once I've told all these stories about like my feelings about the clients. So I haven't really gotten any pushback on that. But what I have gotten pushback about is I don't really talk much about the crimes.
Yeah.
And that's very intentional, because I feel like there's a lot of media and storytelling out there about, you know, people who've done terrible things. And my point is more, you know, guys are on death row for 20 years on average. And so they have like real lives.
Yeah.
And there's this terrible thing happening in the background, and there's a lot of human stuff in the foreground. And I wanted to put in the foreground the human stuff, because we were not always thinking about the crimes. So that was really intentional. Because also when you're doing these cases, you're presenting a life story about people, like a psychosocial history. And the crime is one piece of that, but so is their family, so is their mental health, so is their economic status. And I just like loved getting to see this 360 view of people. You never get that in any other context. And that is really what the majority of the work was. So like the show is true to how I felt doing the work. The crime was not the main thing I was thinking about.
So I guess there are at least three things running through the show. You might have on the list, I don't know. But first of all, you've picked some of the cases.
Yeah.
You don't go into a great deal about the cases, but you talk about the individuals. Mm-hmm. You've also got some personal life stuff, mm-hmm. which sort of, I guess, because some of that's quite heavy.
Yes.
So the personal life stuff can really
a little later, yeah.
lighten the mood.
Yeah.
But then also, you are constructing a case for why the death penalty is a bad idea.
Yeah.
Now, we don't need to go into a great deal about it now, because that's what you do in the show.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I guess one question would be, as you say, you kind of, the first case you were involved in, mm-hmm. where there was a death penalty, was almost by accident. Mm-hmm. Did you have
all of it by accident?
Did you have strong opinions about the death penalty then?
No, not at all. I mean, I really had almost never thought about the death penalty. When I first started, Trump had just been elected.
Yeah.
And I just felt like it would be good to kind of be involved in something, but I didn't know anything about criminal law. I didn't take a lot of criminal classes in law school. You know, I tell a joke that if you'd asked me at the time about the death penalty, I probably would have said that there were some crimes that do deserve death, you know, like 9/11, Holocaust, loud chewing. So like, it just hadn't really even occurred to me. I didn't understand the historical context. And it was really just through doing the work that I changed. And that's a large part of what the show is like my journey of feeling very strongly about this thing, not through facts and figures, but through meeting people and just being deep in the system.
And I guess we're going to go into detail because people should go and see the show. But I think when you're talking about the reasons against it, mm-hmm. it's what I found really interesting was, yes, there is the impact on the individual, the criminal, but actually mm-hmm. that's just one part
right.
of it. And you unpack the bigger impact
definitely.
On the many, many other people who are hit by it.
Yeah.
That why, even if you have zero sympathy
yep.
for the actual people sitting on death row,
yeah.
there's still lots of reasons why it's a terrible idea.
Exactly, yeah. It's this really big system that is so out of sight, out of mind for so many people. And I think that's why it kind of gets to continue in the U.S. It's only in some states, executions are only happening sometimes, but it affects the prison workers, it affects jurors, it affects witnesses, it affects the lawyers. I mean, like, I was profoundly impacted by working on these cases. I'm doing a show about it now. Like, I don't know that death penalty will ever not be in my life
yeah.
in some way or another. When you have something so violent, it enacts violence on
yeah.
a lot of people. And so that is an angle that I really haven't heard talked about that much, because people really think about what's happening in the courtroom or what's happening in the prison to these people. And I just wanted to share that it's really a much broader impact. And that's what happens when you have something this difficult.
So let's talk about Edinburgh, your first time here. So what made you think, I need to bring the show to the Edinburgh Festival?
I mean, I've heard amazing things about Fringe. I have a lot of friends that have come, and so I thought it would be fun to debut here. It's also hard to get an hour spot in New York. And it's hard, you know, all the promotion and all of that. Like, I felt like being here, I had a nice hook that I could really be able to bring people in and share. It's like lower stakes than, you know, saying I'm going to go do an hour and tour.
Yeah.
I wanted to be here and see other shows. Like, it seems amazing. Right after Clown School, you know, I was just in France. So now Edinburgh is not that far away.
Yeah.
So like the community of it, the experience of being here seemed amazing. And my impression has been audiences are really open to seeing all different types of things. And that's like my key audience. People who, you know, I don't think anyone comes to the festival saying, when's the death penalty hour? But if I can get people to be interested in it and come and sit in the room with me and learn, like, that's amazing for me.
No, and I do think, I mean, and because I've generally, my experience with comedy has been so informed by being at this festival
yeah.
for so many years. I'm not saying, I've seen lots of great shows which are just straight stand-up.
Yeah.
But the way you have a story
yeah.
to tell, is,
yeah.
that is, I think for me, that's the perfect Fringe show.
Definitely, yeah.
And that beginning, a middle, and end, and you're taken on a journey.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. It's the perfect place.
Yeah. Exactly.
Like this.
And like how fun to be here for a month and like meet other people performing
yeah.
and, you know, having been in Clown School, we were doing more like 3 and 5 minute numbers most of the time. To get to be here and see like all these hour long clown shows is so fun for me. Like the experience of being here was a big part of why I wanted to debut here. And then debuting here is a big part of the experience of like meeting all these different people and sharing.
So if we go to future moving forward, so is the plan, so basically you've been in Europe for over a year now.
Yeah.
So here's the plan to head back to the US and take the show with you?
Yeah, that's my hope. I would love to tour the show in the US. I would love to tour the show in the UK. I also think that there's so much other material in this. I would love to write a book. I think there could be a TV show. Something that's been really on my mind is that there's so much TV about criminal stuff. There's nothing from a defense lawyer's perspective. It's really all from a prosecutor being the protagonist.
Yeah, all the investigators and the police.
Right.
Yeah.
It's always on that side. And like, that's great. That's certainly one perspective. But people are really drawn to the other side. And there's so much humanity in this that I just see a wide variety of media that could be made. So I'm trying to figure out how to expand this beyond the show. But I love the show and I'm excited to perform it in the US more.
And in terms of the clowning.
Yes.
Do you see that becoming part of what you do? Not as this, I mean, you said potentially with this subject matter or just generally as another art form on the site?
I would love to have it be linked. I think it's nice for me to be able to link it and also to just do things that are separate. Like so much of clown is just about being stupid and making people laugh. And that's so fun. My show is not laughs at the expense of other things. And so I like being able to do both. And if there's a way that I can weave them together, then that's great. But I also think sometimes people like use an art, try to push something onto an art form that they don't really mix. And so if I'm going to do it in a clowning way, I want to make sure that it feels like that's the right way to do it. And clown looks so stupid, but it is a lot of work to figure out how you play with things and how you make the tone work and the rhythm throughout the show. So it just takes time to develop. And I would love to develop something with this topic.
Beyond the performance career, I mean, obviously you're very passionate about that subject matter as well. Do you anticipate still getting yourself involved, not necessarily as a lawyer representing those people, but in terms of the campaigning side, the politics side?
Definitely. I mean, I feel like the show I'm doing is part of that.
I would agree, yes.
So I would love to. I don't know exactly what that looks like. I could imagine at some point having a few criminal clients. It's nice for me to have a break. Like last October when I stopped working was the first time in, I think, 9 years that I hadn't had a client who's in prison. It's a lot of pressure to have somebody's life in your hand. And so for this past year to have the only thing that mattered be more people laughing is a nice change of pace. But knowing myself, it's hard to imagine I'm not involved in some bigger way at some point soon.
Okay, well, let's do the plugging bit.
Yes.
So remember, the name of the show, the venue, the listings, all of that.
Great. The show is Josh Bakar Getting Off. It's at Assembly Roxy every night at 7:40 p.m., except the 17th, all the way through the end of August.
And if people want to follow you online?
Yes, at Josh Bakar on every social.
Very straightforward.
Yes.
Well, have a good rest of festival.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us.
Appreciate it.